Hi, I'm Rick Reynolds, and you're listening to A Fair Recovery Radio, Radio to the Power of God. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, sponsors, or advertisers of this station. Due to the sensitive nature of the topics discussed on this program, it is not suitable for children, so we strongly advise that children not be within listening range of this program. Also, please be advised that while we are counselors, what we're doing here tonight is not counseling, and if you have a need, we strongly advise that you seek professional help. The Affair Recovery Center is a community of counseling professionals and couples who have experienced the abundant blessing of reconciliation and renewal. We are dedicated to the restoration of marriages crippled by infidelity. Our mission is to offer hope, support, and recovery for couples and individuals who have suffered the pain as a result of infidelity, betrayal, or sexual addiction. We truly believe there's nothing the nearness of God cannot heal. Hi, this is Rick, and welcome tonight to A Fair Recovery Radio. I am certainly glad that you guys have chosen to join us. And as you know from our email, that we have a special treat tonight. My friend Dave Carter is with us. And I'll tell you what, Dave was really one of the first people whose book I read that I really thought kind of resonated with me. I love Dave's book, Torn Asunder. So, Dave, are you here with us tonight?
I am.
Ah, it's good to hear your voice. Thank you.
Well, I'm looking forward to this.
Well, so am I. I hope to see you again in July, too. You'll be up at Smart Marriages, won't you?
I will.
Good. Well, I look forward to seeing you up there.
Okay.
I really wanted to do two things tonight. I wanted to spend maybe the first moments of the program tonight, Dave, talking about Torn Asunder, and then I wanted to flip around to your new book, because I want people to be aware of what you've written, and certainly I think it's incredibly relevant to where our culture is going. So, in fact, I know it is, to be honest. So would you mind telling our audience, because they may not know this story, why in the world you were led to write Torn Asunder?
Well, it all started back about 30 years ago when my second senior pastor ran off with another woman in a church. I say the second senior pastor because it's the second time it had happened to me. And make a long story short, I tracked him down and arrived in his destination city where he was going with his girlfriend before he did. And then actually had to come back home. Well, he drove the U-Haul truck down, flew back down again, and confronted him. And he was not interested in returning to his family. And I just broke down and wept like a baby, and just uncontrollably. And my friend who was with me drove us back to the airport. And when I finally got control of myself, I looked over him across the car, and I said, you know what, when I get home, I'm going back to graduate school, and I'm going to figure out why guys do this, because it just destroys their own lives, it destroys their families, it destroys their churches. And so initially, I became real interested in pastoral infidelity, and since then have kind of broadened out to really help Christians and even non-believers in recovering from adultery and infidelity issues.
And guys, when Dave says he's broadened out, he's actually one of the leading spokesmen of the field. So he's done more than just broadened out. God has blessed him with an amazing platform, and Dave is amazingly well-respected. And again, if you've read any of his books, then you'll understand that. If you haven't, you need to read them. Now, tonight, if you would like to join us, you can certainly call in at area code 512-637-9673. And as a special treat, Dave's publisher, Moody, has actually sent us some copies of his books. And if you're interested in maybe getting a copy of Torn Asunder or Close Calls, please call in tonight and just let us know. You got to ask a question for Dave, though, because I want to have a little discussion going here. But we'd love for you to call. So call us at area code 512-637-9673. That's 512-637-9673. 637-9673, or you can email me at radio@hope-now.com. That's radio@hope-now.com. So, thanks, Dave. And guys, please call in. We'd love to have you weigh on either his materials or ask him a question. This is a rare opportunity to be able to talk to Dave. So, Do you think one of the things I've appreciated about you, Dave, is some of the research you've done? And I don't know if you've updated any of your research, but how frequently is this problem occurring, and do you think it's widening? Because I know that you've actually done some studies on that.
Yeah, I have. Most of the actual research I've been involved in on a research team in the decade of the 90s was measuring pastoral infidelity. And that was a big surprise to us. Let me talk a little bit about that. Basically, we interviewed 4,000 pastors over 10 years and came up with a base rate of about 20%. One in five had committed adultery while in ministry and married. In addition to that, 14% more said they had lied on the survey. That was the last question on the survey. And the only thing you'd lie about on that survey was whether or not you committed adultery. And the other thing that's really interesting about pastoral infidelity, it's one of the few occupations when you get involved in adultery, you lose your career. And that's not true in every denomination, but it's certainly more true in the pastoral ministry than it is in some other secular business occupations. So we did these surveys at pastors' conferences, and for the most part, we made an assumption that pastors who had committed adultery and the church knew about it weren't attending pastors' conferences anymore. They were selling life insurance or cars or something of that nature and were out of the ministry. So we would estimate that really pastoral infidelity is underreported and probably ranges somewhere between 35 and 40% frequency.
Yeah, that is just amazing to me. You know that, and I think you can see how the men of the cloth, so to speak, certainly are vulnerable. But you know, so's the rest of culture. So
well, they are. Would you like to hear some of the surprises of the research?
Please.
Well, here's some stuff that came right out of the numbers, and as you think about it, it probably makes a little bit more sense. There is what we call a decade of danger, and that is the decade between 31 and 40. Fully 50% of all the pastoral infidelities occurred in that decade. So it's not a matter so much of midlife crisis or that kind of thing. That's the decade of danger, 31 to 40. Secondly, the higher your educational level of training, the more likely you are to commit adultery. So PhDs, THD pastors were much, the frequency of infidelity was quite a bit higher in those degree ranges than it was in a bachelor-level pastor. Third, the younger you were when you trusted Christ as Savior, the more likely you are to commit adultery. Now, that makes a lot of sense as you think about it, because sometimes people who trust Christ when they're children, they're either the faith doesn't grow, they maybe become a little envious of people who get a chance to sow their wild oats, and they didn't. But guys who trusted Christ in their late 20s or early 30s were much less likely to commit adultery while in ministry and married than guys who had trusted Christ when they were much younger. So there are some interesting things out there. The most dangerous area for pastors, or the most dangerous time in their marriage for them to commit adultery, was when their wife was pregnant.
Right.
So that time of pregnancy and the year afterwards is a really high-risk period of time for pastoral infidelity.
Yeah, we found that in our research also.
Yeah.
It's amazing. About the point of inception until a kid's about 18 months old is a time period we look at, and it is high.
I agree.
So what about, do you have any ideas why that age 31 to 40? Do you have a hypothesis on that,
Dave?
Well,
here's what I would say about that. Lots of guys go to seminary. The time they finish seminary and they're coming into their churches, they've been in ministry maybe 8 to 10 years at the most. It's a time when they're having families. So their wives are bearing children during this period of time. It's a time when they're kind of cutting their teeth on ministry itself. They might have come out of a graduate program and just been really exhausted. They might have come out of a graduate program with a sense of entitlement. So I think that first decade out of seminary and into ministry is really a risky time period. There's a lot of dynamics, I think, both within the pastor and within the pastor's family that contribute to that.
Any ideas on why the PhDs?
Well, we've believe you me, the research committee, we bandied that about because we're all in the graduate level.
Exactly.
Here's what we came up with, and they're just speculations, but oftentimes with a greater level of education comes a greater sense of entitlement. So there's oftentimes the thought that goes that you deserve something, or maybe this is maybe not appropriate, but it's something you're going to try. Secondly, the higher the level of the education, usually the broader the gray range between what's right and what's wrong.
Right.
More educated people have a tendency just to see things a little less black and white. Third, we also speculated that doctoral level people probably are a bit exhausted, emotionally, financially, physically drained after doing a doctoral level program. Fourth, a well-educated man is a better target. And we think there probably are women who are especially attracted to powerful people, well-educated people. And we can see that kind of a man becoming the target of such an effort. And those are the kind of things we came up with.
That's neat. Mm-hmm. And remember, guys, you can call in and talk to Dave if you want to comment on this stuff at area code 512-637-9673. One of the things I really enjoyed about Torn Asunder when I read it, Dave, was you talked a lot about the message of the affair.
Mm-hmm.
Would you mind explaining that? And just for our audience, I'd love for them to hear your explanation of all of that.
Well, my view of the message of the affair has changed over the years, but it still contains this idea. Many individuals who get caught up in infidelity are not looking for it. They don't necessarily they're not on the hunt. They're not out there poaching or whatever the case is. But they have tried to share with their spouse, either their husband or their wife, how unhappy they might be in the marriage or what they need more of in the marriage, and they're not getting any response. And so the affair is a last ditch effort to either say, this is what I need, or this is what I haven't had, or it also can say the thought, I'm fed up, I'm giving up, I don't care, this is very important to me. And there can be a number of sub-points in that message, but their affairs are not irrational, and it's very important to remember that. Most people who are close to the person having the affair try to view the behavior as irrational, or they're mentally ill, or they're this or that. I don't believe that at all. I think it's very intentional. I don't think it's a curse. I just think it's an intentional response pattern.
Right, and we have a call. Do you mind if we take a question?
Not at all.
Okay, we've got Eric. Are you there?
Hey, Rick.
Hey, Eric. You have a question for Dave?
Well, I was just going to echo some sentiments that or affirm Dave with what he said, and not necessarily from a pastor standpoint, but when he talked about being a target because of your position or you know the power of that position, I'm in recovery from sex addiction, and Rick, as you know, I was a former police officer, and anyways, it there was this underlying tension, and I could definitely sense it from women at times where they were attracted to that position, and they would let it be known in some instances that they're attracted to that position no matter what your status. Mm-hmm. And so that just that immense temptation, I mean, blatantly right in your face. I mean, I can only imagine how difficult that must be for pastors to have to deal with, and you know, when they're in a community where they're being a spiritual leader and also at times even quasi counselor for families that are going through struggles, you know, and then also just being a manager, being part of the management team of the church. So, you know, I just want to affirm what Dave said about that. And that's really all I have, Rick.
Thank you, Eric.
I tell you, I think you're right on the money. I think uniforms turn women on. No, I'm serious. I really do. I think most people look great in uniforms. So
I think there's a lot of truth to that. Here in Austin, we do a lot of work with the military, so certainly something's happening with the uniforms.
Yeah.
And it's sad, and, of course, all of it. I mean, we sometimes, you don't want to make light of that, but it is. I think that whole power thing, maybe it's a little bit of the passivity that happens to men in this particular culture and what's happened for the last 30 years or so, but it's a problem. And so when you have someone that is powerful, I think it's very appealing.
Well, I think it provides a sense of protection, too, and it also gives or grants the woman, although it can be the other way around, grants the woman the sense that she's important because this person of power wanted to be with her. So,
right.
It works all kinds of different ways, I think.
Right. Well, Eric, thank you for calling tonight.
Rick.
Okay.
Thanks, Dave.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome, Eric.
Bye.
Okay, we've got Kathy. Kathy, you there?
Hey, Rick.
Hello, Miss Kathy.
How are you?
I'm doing fine tonight.
Good. Hey, Dave Carter, I want to tell you that when I went through my discovery, my pastor counselor gave me your book, the first book I got, and it was absolutely awesome. I think you've done a really good job on Torn Asunder.
Well, thank you, Kathy.
You're welcome.
Was it helpful?
It was very helpful. I've read it through three times and just went back through it again tonight just so I could refresh myself. But I wanted to make a comment to Eric. Eric, you're right. Women are attracted to men in uniform, even if it's the milkman. And my next question, here's my question I would really like an answer to. I was reading a book, and I cannot remember which book it was, but it says that about 80% of marriages will have some form of infidelity in them. Do you believe that, Dave?
Well, that number would be a little high. There was a book published just this last summer that's kind of a collection of all the research on infidelity. And most of the initial research on infidelity has focused on frequency because that's the easiest thing to attach a number to. And I would say that among all those studies cited in that book, that's pretty high.
Okay.
I would say it would be closer to 2/3 in the secular community.
Okay.
And I would say in the Christian community, a pretty safe number, depending on which survey you read, is about, here's the phrase I use. By the time the partners in the Christian marriage reach the age of 40, 40% of them will have had an infidelity in their marriage.
Well, that's pretty high in the Christian community.
But I wouldn't say 80. 80 is awfully high, I think.
Well, I think what they were talking about was all around, both in the secular and the Christian. I don't think they were. I think it was just combined in marriage.
Well, if they're talking about sexual infidelity, that's pretty high.
It didn't say sexual. It said some form of infidelity.
Well, might be.
Well, here's my question.
Sure.
If it's true, if there is that kind of a statistic out there for that kind of infidelity, why is it so high and so hard for people to forgive infidelity? Like friends and people that know, like let's say you got up and you told people, I had been unfaithful, and it's like they scatter. Why do they do that?
I'm not sure, Kathy, what the question is. Are you asking why they scatter, why they don't listen to it?
Well, yeah, it's not like really listen to it, but like if you tell a friend or you tell maybe somebody you're not a friend with, yeah, my husband's been unfaithful to me, whatever, it's like they immediately judge. And then they have a hard time getting past what your husband's done.
Oh, I don't think it's so much, Kathy, they judge. I think it strikes a note in their own heart. About
their own
guilt.
Fear. Is it guilt for them or their own fear of maybe it happening to them?
Well, I think they're afraid of it happening to them. It's like, this is contagious. So stay away from it. because it's very contagious.
So that's why, even though the world sees it as so immoral, and so many yet so many people do it, they just can't hear about it.
That's what I was saying. Now, Kathy, remember though, sex is very nurturing to especially males. When men are anxious and depressed, they will first act out sexually. Sex is the big mood elevator for males. Now, when women are anxious and depressed, they'll eat. That's just the way it works. That's the way it is. They're hardwired for the most part. Now, there's always exceptions, but sex is to men what food is to women. It's comfort food.
Okay. I get
that. And when men are under lots of stress, one of the very best ways to alleviate it is through sexual acting out. And it doesn't just mean an affair. It could be massage parlors, strip joints, pornography, all that kind of stuff.
Okay. Well, earlier, here a minute ago, you were talking about majority of infidelity is caused by the infidel coming to the partner and telling their partner feelings, and the partner's not paying attention.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's where the affairs get involved, right there.
Right there. Okay, mm-hmm. So it goes either way, right?
Because, it does.
Like, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but don't mix up the four classes of infidelity. And they're all a little different. I can review those now if you'd like to hear
them. That would be great, Dave, if you don't mind.
Yeah, okay. Well, class one is that famous one-night stand thing that's unplanned, unpremeditated, and almost universally alcohol is involved in it. And it's just a situation of convenience. It's like David and Bathsheba. And there's very little emotional attachment. They often don't know each other. There's a great degree of secrecy surrounding it. But class two is what you're talking about, Kathy. That's the one where there's a long-term friendship that takes quite a while to develop. It's platonic at first. Eventually it becomes inappropriate, involves a lot of sharing and closeness. This is where the person feels like they found a soulmate. They fall in love with each other. They buy gifts for each other. And this affair usually runs 18 to 24 months before it burns out. Or they run off with each other. That's one of the two options here. Class three is what we call sexual addiction, where there's sexual compulsivity. That would be like Eli's sons in the Old Testament, just having sex with whoever came to the temple type of thing. Class four, though, is what we call a marital deficit affair. And this is where one spouse in the marriage has an interest that they don't share with the other spouse. The other spouse is not interested in that particular. Maybe they can't sing and the one spouse sings. So they get the spouse that has this interest gets involved in doing whatever this interest is, and over the course of doing this with other people or being involved in this group or this ministry or this music or this hiking club or this biking club or whatever it is, builds a friendship that becomes erotic. Now, it's very sporadic. There's no gifts involved. They don't meet outside this interest. It has a very narrow band of activity, and the sexual activity itself is very infrequent.
So is that the sex addiction?
No, that's the class four infidelity.
Okay.
The marital deficit. Class three, sexual addiction, is very compulsive and habitual.
Okay. So like, when you say that the unfaithful spouse may be telling the faithful spouse their needs and the faithful spouse isn't listening, which class does that fall under?
Well, that's almost always true in class two and class four, that there's some unmet needs in the marriage.
So in sex addiction, you're saying that...
That has nothing to do with the marriage.
Okay.
Sex addiction was brought usually from childhood into the marriage.
Okay.
Through exposure to pornography, sexual activity that was inappropriate, either on the part of males or females, molestation issues, all that kind of stuff.
That
has a long history.
Where does premeditation fall into that?
Premeditation on the part of the sex addict?
Not necessarily a sex addict, but someone who feels like their needs aren't getting met.
Well, I'm not sure where it falls into it. They often begin to fixate on it and think about it and dwell on it, and they get hurt and they get angry, And when those two dynamics begin to surface, the person will start looking. And they don't even have to look. This is the interesting thing. I didn't believe this at first, but I've heard this over and over again in the counseling office. I've had people tell me that they can look across a crowd of people and tell who is unhappy in their marriage. They can just look and see who's unhappy in their marriage. And I actually had one woman just recently tell me, I go after the person who's unhappy in their marriage because I don't want any more rejection. And even if we can only make each other happy just for a few minutes, it's worth it. So they actually look for, they send out signals. When you're unhappy in your marriage, you do send out signals that other people are out there and will pick up on.
Absolutely, and depression is one of those.
Yeah, it is.
Okay, so which class of affairs does, like the faithful spouse is telling the unfaithful spouse all the needs and the unfaithful spouse...
Well, that's going to be part of the recovery in any affair. And even that'll be a part of the recovery even in sexual addiction after sobriety is achieved.
Okay, but what I mean, Dave, is if it's the faithful spouse has been telling the unfaithful spouse, let's say their whole marriage, then their needs that aren't being met and the things that they need, and the unfaithful spouse is not listening and doesn't really care, what class of affair does that fall under?
Well, I don't know why the unfaithful spouse acted out. You haven't told me that.
Can I answer this one?
Sure.
Yes, you may.
Yeah, because, Kathy, what you're dealing with is sexual addiction. And so anything, I mean, because it's not about you, and you know, especially in your case, because I'm familiar with your case, what you say really has very little influence because it's not driven by you. And now, also, I think his sexual addiction left you very vulnerable and kind of, he was so, you know, in his compulsion, I think it was incredibly difficult for him to be responsive to you until he began to get into recovery himself.
Correct. But see, I have another couple that I've been talking to, and she's been trying to do everything she can to get her husband to hear her needs. They've even gone to counseling. He doesn't even hear them in there. Now, there's been no infidelity yet proven, but it's been suspicioned. So it just made me wonder, does that fall into class 2 or class 3, class 4?
Well, if no infidelity has occurred, then there is no class to worry about.
Okay, so but if it's suspected and it gets found out to be true...
Okay, Kathy, here's what you need to ask your friend. Okay. Ask her this question. If you knew your husband was sexually inappropriate and acting out sexually, would it change anything in your relationship? And if she answers the question yes, then you tell her she needs to go find out the truth no matter what it costs her. It might mean hiring a private investigator. It might mean getting several of her friends together and staking out the house, staking out his work, taking out where they suspect maybe he might be going with his sexual addiction. Find out the truth. The truth sets people free. But if she says, no, it wouldn't change anything in our relationship, then she should just be quiet, is what I would tell her, and wait and see what happens.
Okay, so basically then the one that it falls under then, if the unfaithful spouse or suspected unfaithful spouse isn't listening to the other spouse's needs, is a sex addiction.
Well, I don't know if there's enough information to determine that.
Okay, okay.
But that's a great segue, though, into the second book.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to go listen.
Okay.
Well, thanks for taking my question, Dave.
Surely.
Okay.
Good night, Kathy.
Well, I have one quick question.
Okay.
How often would you say that men or women who act out with infidelity... because their needs aren't getting met, what would the percentage be on people who act out once, maybe twice, and then because of acting out, learn their lesson?
That's a great question. I don't think I've ever seen any research on that.
Oh, I was just curious.
Yeah. Here's what I'll tell you why that would be so hard to research. Who am I speaking to?
Ronnie.
Ronnie, when people have an affair... or they have a one-night stand, unless they're drunk, many times the infatuation in that affair or in that relationship, even though they've kind of learned a lesson, it just kind of sits back there in the back of their mind. And the next time they go through high periods of stress or exhaustion or boredom or whatever, they go back to that and have a tendency to cultivate it and think about it because it makes them feel better. It's a mood changer. And that's how come there we often see these serial one-night stands in people's lives, every 3 to 5 years, for instance. And that's because they're using this to kind of as a form of medication, of self-treatment. Now, that's what I suspect would happen with somebody who maybe had had one or two or three affairs, brief affairs in a marriage.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. In fact, Dave, we're doing some research right now that might catch that. So I will let you know. I'll let you know. Hopefully we'll be crunching some numbers on that this summer, trying to see what we come up with. So, because I agree with you. I mean, I think that a lot of times if someone crosses the boundary once and doesn't address it, the thing I know is that once somebody's done it, I know they're capable of doing it.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't just go away.
Yeah.
It now is part of a potential repertoire that I think, you know, literally the enemy can use to capture and take them back there again. It's a lot easier the second time than the first time.
It is.
And
you don't think that some men would get rattled just by the, if they had never done it before and they're under some great stress, they do it and they realize, wait a minute, I was way out of control.
Yeah.
Well, I think they can hide it. I would agree with Rick. They could hide it, but I just think it's something that's just festering right there, ready to burst back into flame again.
Right. And the other thing, Ronnie, I think, is that people, a lot of times what stops them is kind of fear, guilt, and shame. And the reality is those are great stoppers for a season, but eventually they wear off, and the same misery that was present when they acted out the first time will be back.
Yeah. It's not worth it, they'll say.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then they're vulnerable again, which still is a great segue to this new book, which I really wanted to talk about. So tell us a little bit about Close Calls. And again, now what caused you to write this book? Because this is I've been going through this. I didn't get to read it as much as I wanted. I've been skiing with my son up in Oregon. I just got in this evening, Dave.
Oh, wow.
And so it came. He's at George Fox University up there at Newburgh, Oregon.
Ah.
And he wanted me to come down before finals. I think he should have been studying for his finals, but... He wanted me to see his new acquired snowboarding skills with all of his friends from the university. So I didn't get to start reading your book till this evening.
No, you did the right thing. Don't worry.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. I'm just a little old to be going down the slope chasing college kids.
Yeah, I understand.
But, you know, anything for the kids.
Yeah.
So anyway, how did this book come about, Dave?
Well, for years I've been using the research and the torn asunder concepts to kind of wake people up to what could be happening in their lives and talking about the classes of infidelity and the development and all that kind of stuff. And I've always been concerned that something more preventive needs to be developed. And torn asunder is remedial in the sense of it's reparative, it's very helpful that way, but there's not a lot of stuff out there that really prevents it. And one of the things that has impressed me recently in the last 10 years in the church is how often men and women are working and serving together. It kind of becomes the Christian workplace, the church does.
Right.
Has. Nothing wrong with that. I'm all in favor of it.
Mm-hmm.
But in that process, I've seen a number of close calls. And then you look into the technology and you're seeing email and you're seeing texting, and there's just more ways to hide communication between people. So here, several years ago, about 4 or 5 years ago, I started focusing on close calls. And a close call is basically a normal attraction to somebody other than your spouse. And I want to say normal. You're going to recognize an attractive woman, attractive man. You're going to just... attraction is just going to happen. And as my wife and I kept talking about this, we experienced this in our own lives. And I got to thinking, you know, how does this kind of lead into flirting, and how does this lead into emotional affairs? And that was another trigger to this. I was seeing more and more emotional affairs.
Right.
Whether it was little or no, even kissing or no sexual activity at all. But there was this deep attachment, and I was just having the hardest time separating somebody from this dear friend of the opposite sex when they said, I've done nothing wrong. So that's where close calls comes from, trying to prevent what is normal from going any further.
So how do you delineate between like an emotional affair and flirting from the close call?
Well, I think close calls are normal. I think close calls happen, though, these normal attractions happen sometimes to us when we're in more vulnerable straits than we are at other times. For instance, after a severe or sustained period of stress in our lives, I think we're more vulnerable to somebody paying attention to us, maybe making a nice comment about the work we've done, or that little brush of the shoulder where they just kind of touch your arm, just sends shivers up and down you. And it's like you're starved for touch or starved for attention. That's what the close call is. It's this immediate and kind of an emotionally overwhelming experience. Now, it's still not an emotional affair because you've not cultivated or grown it, and you've not dished anything back, like flirting. But it's a close call.
So do you think that each person has a person, Dave, that they're ultimately going to be susceptible to?
See, this is the thing, Rick, I've just been so impressed with clinically. I would love to do some research on this. I'm going to give you an illustration from the Bible everybody's aware of. Let's say we took David, King David, and 24 hours before he slept with Bathsheba, let's say I said to David, David, tomorrow this time, you're going to have sex with another man's wife. You're going to make that woman pregnant. God's going to kill the baby. You're going to kill the husband. Your kids are going to start having sex with each other, and one of your kids is going to try to kill you and steal the kingdom. Now, if I had told that to David 24 hours before he slept with Bathsheba, he would have said, no way, I'd never do that. But when that woman crossed his field of vision, he fell immediately. So that story has just intrigued me for years. So basically what I've done, Rick, in the book Close Calls, I've identified seven areas called risk factors in people's lives. Research is pretty good on this. I don't think you'd have any problem with those. You take those risk factors and you take them through sustained stress. And by that, I mean 2 years worth of stress. And when this dangerous partner profile crosses your field of vision, you will fall. It's a lock. And the point is, you're not attracted. You, Rick, myself, we're not all attracted to the same women. All the women aren't the same attraction to us. And same with women. Not all men are equally attracted to them. It's a particular person. And in close calls, just clinically at this point, I've identified 8 different areas that seem to be significant in people, in helping people identify who their dangerous partner profile is.
So, and I agree with you 100%. One of the things we talk about here is that temptation does not define you.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, if temptation defined you, then the person with the most temptation would be the vilest person, and that would be Christ.
Yeah.
And he wasn't vile, so we know temptation doesn't define us. But we still, I think, as human beings, are amazingly shameful that we would ever find someone being tempted. So do you think it's kind of that whole shame dynamic that causes people not to talk about that temptation?
Oh, see, that's what I think happens. And they hide this attraction, and they even think about it because of the emotional response to the normal attraction, and that's where they start getting into trouble. So the last chapter of the book has a contract that husbands and wives can sign and agree to talk about these kinds of attractions and why they happen and when they happen. It's not who they happened with, but what is it about this person that seems to be especially significant in your life at this point in time?
Yeah, it's interesting. In our work, one of the things, we do a lot of work on prevention. And when we're doing preventive work, it's actually the least favorite the least favorite segment of everything we do.
Yeah.
We get more wailing and gnashing of teeth over prevention work than the reparative work.
Uh-huh.
Largely because I think it scares them half to death. So I can only imagine, so you've written a book here where you've given people a test and you're going to let them discover what type of person they're really attracted to.
Yeah.
Do spouses tend to go up and sideways? Have you had that happen in your office?
Well, clinically speaking, I only see people who are recovering from affairs. I hardly ever see a close call. Now, lately, though, in the last several months, I've had four or five of those since I've started talking about this in several little public forums around here in Southern California. You know, for instance, a guy who has a job in a Christian ministry, they find 700 text messages on his cell phone. They fire him. He has to go home and tell his wife. You know, it's that kind of stuff. That's a close call that's being cultivated. That's getting borderline flirtatious and inappropriate. It's certainly inappropriate anyway. But these attractions are normal experiences that people need to recognize what they are. They're normal. The more Christian men and women work together, serve together, you share a heart passion with somebody because you're in this same ministry together that you don't share with your spouse or your spouse doesn't see it quite like that, you share hearts. You got to be very careful you don't share bodies.
Absolutely. And again, I just want to say real quick, if you want to call in and ask a question, I haven't given the number in a while. It's area code 512-637-9673. 512-637-9673. So in this thing, so we've got people that we will naturally and normally be attracted to.
That's right.
So without ruining the sell of your book or anything like that, because I'm going to recommend your book highly, but what do you say they should do from that point? I mean, how are they going to handle that attraction? What's the best thing to do to keep themselves safe?
Well, that's a great question, Rick. But let me say a couple things about this dangerous partner profile template, so to speak. This person is usually a composite. It's not one individual. It's a composite of experiences maybe from adolescence, maybe a composite of old girlfriends. It could involve movie actors or actresses, sports figures. It could involve a romantic night with somebody, a prom. It's a composite. And that's real important to remember. It's usually not just a single individual. The second thing that's important, you didn't marry your dangerous partner profile because intuitively you knew they were not good for you.
Right.
You married the person you married intentionally because that really was what you needed. But the dangerous partner still has a lot of intrigue and attraction, and that's what couples need to talk through. What is that? Because that's the kind of stuff you can pull out of that template of that other person and build into your marriage. You can do that in any number of ways. So it's nothing to be afraid of. It's going to happen whether you're afraid of it or not anyway. So just be aware of it and talk about it.
Do you think, Dave, in your thoughts on this, that the dangerous person profile, that composite, composite person actually contains maybe characteristics that we kind of want or would like to have for ourselves that are missing within ourselves sort of thing?
I think that's definitely part of it. Yeah, I do. Something that makes you feel whole and complete, you know, meets a void, meets an emptiness that came out of your family of origin because your own parents were maybe divorced or weren't available or whatever. Yeah, all those attachment issues.
Right.
Yep.
Yep.
That's where it is.
Exactly, and I think it's really interesting if people will begin to explore, you know, what are those things? So, I mean, I'm really glad you're kind of bringing that type of thought out, especially in the Christian community. I think it's easier to hear it and maybe go down that line in some of the secular stuff, but I think in the Christian community, we really haven't done a very good job of kind of exploring some of those things.
No, I agree with you. You know, one of the things, too, Rick, that really disturbs me a lot is what I call corporate dating.
Right.
It just drives me nuts.
Yeah, we've got Dell here in Austin.
Yeah.
It's been quite good for business.
Well, businesses will send two people on a business trip, a male and female on a business trip. They'll give them almost unlimited expenses to entertain clients at very expensive meals, which they could never buy with their spouse. They can drink however much alcohol they care to consume. They will send them on entertainment venues to entertain these clients, and they'll send them back to the hotel at night, the same hotel, maybe different rooms, but the same hotel. That's a date.
Oh, absolutely.
That's a date. And
well,
it just irritates
yeah,
me.
It sets it up, and I like that concept, office mate. I can't tell you how many people I've been treating lately that have their office mate.
Yeah.
And I, it all comes from that particular, I think, kind of corporate America, the way they have people travel. One of the things that I've kind of been appalled at is just there's a lot of activities where spouses are excluded.
That's right.
And so team building activities typically exclude spouses and really, again, promote that intimacy.
It does.
And, man, that is just incredibly dangerous.
Well, and what happens, this is when you know that close call is becoming inappropriate. It's when you begin to save things to talk about with this other person because they understand you better than your spouse does. So you save certain information or certain areas or certain conversational topics you don't talk about with your spouse because they won't understand it. So you talk about it with your office mate or whoever it is you work with, and you're building an you're taking a close call, and you're going to build an inappropriate affair if you're not careful.
You know, I'd almost suggest, Dave, and you can tell me if I'm wrong on this, that it's there's one step even before saving things to talk to them about it. It's that stage where you keep trying to think of something to say to them to just begin to engage them.
Yeah. I think that's probably true. Hanging around the water cooler, hoping they'll come by.
Right, and thinking of all the lines, what could I say, running that through your head. So, you know, I think if somebody's already kind of planning what we could text or what I could say or how we could hang around and bump into them, that's a pretty good indicator at that point.
Yeah,
certainly it's there if you're saving things to talk to them about.
Yeah.
It's not even iffy anymore at that point.
Yeah, well, that's what I call starving the marriage and feeding the friendship.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, so let's say you get this situation going. So, like in ministry, obviously that's an incredibly fertile ground then to create close calls because you've got people working together, like maybe in youth ministry.
Yeah.
And I was in music ministry for years. The whole worship team thing going.
Yeah.
And in fact, that part of my final affair ended up in that type of situation years ago.
Mm.
So, and it is almost like that category four thing, where you've got something in common, there's that
yep.
composite and all of that. So what do you suggest in that type of situation? Are you saying they can't serve together? Or
no, I would never say that. But whoever is in charge, let's just take the worship team. Whoever is in charge of that worship team needs to talk about this before something bad happens in the group. Guys, this is what happens when you serve together. You need to be on your toes about it. I'm not going to assume it's not going to happen. I'm going to assume it will happen. So somebody needs to bring these kinds of issues out, and that's what I hope close calls will provide an avenue for people to talk about this kind of stuff. I think, secondly, Rick, you need to make a contract with your spouse that, you know what, this happens. It just happens. You say, I hear wives say all the time, well, I stay at home. I'm a homeschooler. You know, I never get out much. If you take your kids to soccer practice or softball or baseball, then you're out sharing something that maybe somebody there would suddenly want to talk with you about. And everybody has a dangerous partner profile. So I would say every spouse needs to work together through this contract. It's very brief, but it's very thorough, too. And it normalizes threatening behavior to the marriage. It actually creates a whole new level of intimacy, though, I think.
Right.
To talk about this.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's a tremendous amount of strengthening in a marriage when you can begin to talk about these things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because, I mean, now the intimacy is happening within the marriage. I mean, just talking about it creates the intimacy.
Oh, it does. It does.
So you mentioned several barriers.
Yeah.
Would you mind laying some of those out? Because
No.
sounded like those could be some fun.
Oh, I'd be glad to. First of all, respect. It's really critical. It's a great protector. And in close calls, I have a little respect quiz. Now, respect isn't just for men. Women also need to be respected. And this will give spouses an opportunity to kind of evaluate the level of respect they feel in their marriage. That's critical. Secondly, we often, in the area of addiction, I'm sure you're familiar with this, we use the word halt in alcohol recovery and alcohol prevention.
Right.
Relapse prevention all the time. And I've added the word be to it. So it's hungry, angry, lonely, tired, and bored. And those mood states occur in all of us all the time at various levels of intensity. But the more of those mood states that are present at any given afternoon or evening, the more risk there is that you will break the boundaries that you've established. So that's a good way to kind of measure what's going on inside of me. Third thing in there, we all have friendships, and I'm all for heterosexual friendships. I think they can exist in some fashion, depending upon how the spouse feels about it. But there I have about a 15 or 17-point friendship quiz to really help you be honest about how intense this friendship is to you. Because when a spouse begins to feel threatened, as in the DSM-4, when there's conflict over your drinking, you're abusing alcohol. When there's conflict over a friend, it's a bad friendship.
Right. Yeah, something's wrong at that point.
Yeah, it is. It is. So you got the friendship thing going. You got respect. You've got your own internal mood states. And then one of the things I do with couples, I say to couples all the time, most couples, I said tonight when I was counseling this one couple, most couples get in trouble because they stop doing what they do best. So here's a little thing I have them do all the time. Identify eight, each one of you, husbands and wives, you privately, identify the eight great moments in your marriage. And the wedding ceremony doesn't count, and the birth of your children doesn't count. So give me eight great moments. And so that's a homework assignment. They go home, figure that out, and they merge those. And so usually they have three or four that match. And then the wife gets the next one, number five, and he'll get number six, she'll get number seven, number eight. Those eight items are their medication to treat their marriage any time it needs help.
Man, that is a great idea. Do you mind if I use that assignment?
No, not at all.
Okay, so it's going to be the eight
greats. They call them eight greats.
Eight greats for the marriage. Eight great moments you've had in your marriage.
Yep, and the husband and the wife each do a separate list. Don't talk about it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and you have to rule out all the births of the kids and the marriage ceremony itself.
Boy, that sounds great. I will use that tomorrow, Dave. Thank you, bro.
Well, you know, self-help is important, I think.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think sometimes they get in such a fog, they just can't see their way out of the bag, you know? So.
Right. Absolutely. So let's say that somebody's listening to us talk tonight, mm-hmm. and they kind of go, wow, you know, that's exactly what's happening to me or my spouse, and they begin to see that maybe they're in the midst of a close call right now.
Yeah.
What would you tell them?
I would tell the first thing you need to do is to back off and take a look at this thing and not continue in it until you can kind of figure out exactly what's going on. Second thing I would say you needed to do was you need to bring it up with your wife or your husband, as the case might be. Now, even if the spouse gets upset, that shows they care about this relationship. And if the one who's in the middle of the close call has a resource like the book, Close Calls, they can help the spouse understand this is normal. Now, there are people out there, Rick, as you well know too, who cultivate close calls. They like going from close call to close call to close call. And they'll flirt with anybody, and they'll look for somebody they can have this close call with. That's not what we're talking about here. We're not talking about a personality structure that needs this kind of thing for emotional nurturance. We're talking about the normal accidental attraction that occurs in everyday life.
Right. Because I do agree that, you know, what you just described in terms of people who are flirting or what I call that is the old grooming behaviors.
Oh, yeah. Good word. Good word.
They're really just trying to draw that other person to them, I would say, for their own self-glorification.
Oh, they are. They're fishing.
You know, they're casting that lure. And
that's right.
And to me, that's about the biggest sin you can commit, which is, you know, robbing God of glory and trying to take the glory for yourself. And really, when you think about it, when we're kind of doing that sort of behavior, we're trying to get the glory.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's kind of a scary thing, but absolutely. So, you know, and I think that's going to be really the good thing about this book. So if someone is seeing the close calls, so if I've got a wife who is in a bunch of close calls and her husband sees it and maybe she doesn't, then this may be something they can go through together then.
They can. Yep, that's exactly what I wrote it for.
And develop maybe a common language of how in the world do we begin to talk about these things whenever we see this in each other's lives.
That's right.
Do you recommend that the couples kind of give permission to speak to each other about close calls?
Yeah, I think they should. That's what the contract's all about. It promises not to get angry when I hear this. I'm promised to be vulnerable. If you think someone is trying to create a close call with me, there's several points in that contract that will really provide a common ground for both husband and wives to talk about this. In our culture, this is going to increase because, one, 50% of our couples out there have never seen a good marriage up close and personal.
Right.
Okay? So how in the world can you build something you've never seen? It's all by, it's hard, it's very hard when you've never seen it practiced. Secondly, our culture also encourages us to tell ourselves maybe we didn't marry the right person rather than maybe we're not behaving like the right person.
Right.
So we put it on our spouse as being the problem instead of taking a good, long, hard look at ourselves. And then third, you throw in all the stress of this culture and the speed at which this culture moves, and we have people who need help and distraction and nurturance and care and probably need more at times than their spouse can provide. So close calls is going to continue to be a big issue in couples.
Yeah, it's interesting. I know that in our recovery, Dave, when Steffi and I were beginning the process, I just had to accept, and I you didn't say this, and maybe this would fit one of your other ones, which is almost like you have to become a bit like a child and be open channel and just begin to believe that maybe you don't understand everything.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that maybe your mate sees things that you're clueless to.
Yeah.
And so I remember I told Stephanie, okay, anytime you see a dangerous situation, I'm going to trust your instincts over mine because obviously mine are messed up.
Yeah.
And I was amazed at the things that she was able to start pointing out to me when I actually opened up the door for her to begin to speak things.
Yeah.
And boy, I tell you, it was an absolute eye-opener for me.
Yeah. But you gave her the environment that she felt safe in doing that.
Right.
That is so important, Rick. Because who wants to fight all the time about this kind of stuff?
Right. It wouldn't have been fun if I'd been getting defensive every time she said, well, this person's coming on to you, you know?
Yeah.
I would have said, you're kid, come on.
Yeah.
Get over it.
Yeah.
You know, so I just have to admit that maybe she can see things better than I can.
Yeah. Well, this book will help both spouses build strong intuitions. And that's really, I think, necessary in this day and age.
Well, if you don't mind, we will push it as much as we can and try to help the process a little bit. Because, I mean, I just believe in what you're doing, Dave.
Oh, thanks.
I mean, I really do. And, you know, it's wonderful to get to work with you and to be a part of all of these things that,
well,
you know, they're going on in the church here.
I always enjoy those conversations at Smart Marriages, so.
Yeah, well, I look forward to seeing you in July.
Okay.
And thank you for joining us this evening. We're about out of time, so I've got to sign off here. So.
Okay.
Have a good evening, Dave.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate the opportunity.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Good night.
Good night.
So, guys, that's Dave Carter. Two books we were discussing, Close Calls by Dave Carter and Torn Asunder, which has also a workbook. Please, Dave is a very, very good author. I love his books. He does a great job, I think, at explaining things, and Close Calls, I think, would be a real blessing for you. So you ought to look into those things. Just a reminder, this next weekend, we actually have an EMS. So if you're in crisis or know of somebody in crisis, the EMS is going to be in Austin on the 25th, the 26th, and the 27th. Of this month of April's. That'll be next weekend. So actually, we will not have anybody in the studio. We'll have our typical mentor couple kind of speaking at the EMS weekend. So we'd like you to hear those stories of how people actually were able to move beyond things. Thank you for praying for John and Leslie last week. They should be getting back in. I think they came in today from Europe, so we appreciate that. And the next online Marriage 911 group is beginning Tuesday evening. So if you need that, please just give us a call, area code 512-346-9299. Have a great week.